Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Porta. Search and rescue in Alaska is complex and difficult. Search operations are challenged by steep mountains, avalanches, bad weather, and cold rivers and lakes. In December, I attended an event organized by the Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol featuring a panel discussion on search and rescue in Alaska. Amanda Del Fronte with Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs, Amy Holman with the Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol, Jonathan Bryan with Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, and Matt Carhart with Alaska Incident Management Team. The event was moderated by Abby Elbow and Esther Kennedy, both with the Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol. The panel discussion was held at the BP Energy Session in Anchorage with an audience. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. Today, we're listening to a roundtable discussion on search and rescue in Alaska. We start with representatives from four different organizations answering the question of what does it take to get involved in volunteering with their organization. The panelists are, in order of their initial responses, Amanda Del Fronte with Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs, Jonathan Bryan with Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, Emma Holman with Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol, and Mont Scarhart with Alaska Incident Management Team.
I think every team has kind of their own process. For ASARD, we have a multi-step process where anybody can come to our trainings. You can come hide for the dogs. You don't have to be a member. We encourage you to come because a stranger is the best resource that we can have for training the dogs, because if we only train on people they know, they'll only know how to find people they know. But if you want to become a member, the first level would be what we call a support member, and that's just the intro. You don't have to know anything. We only ask that you submit an application and attend two monthly meetings. And then the next level would be our field support members, which are our deployable members. And those, we have a whole list of human qualifications for like first aid, radio, helicopter, boat safety, ICS. I'm forgetting quite a few, but we have a big checklist of pretty much you need to be able to survive in the wilderness. And so once you work through that checklist and submit it to the board, then you are now considered deployable with our team and can support our dog teams in the field. And you have to be a field support member to be able to deploy a dog into the field. And so you can join with a dog. We don't always encourage it because sometimes it'll help to like know more about how to train dogs before jumping in full 2 feet in and just going full force into it. But yeah, I think I covered most of our requirements.
Could I just ask a quick follow-up? With those human and dog training qualifications, do you provide that training as part of your team, or is that something people are working through on their own?
Like, do we train your dog, or?
Sorry, more for the people as you're sort of working.
We help provide some trainings. A lot of our trainings can be covered through, like, online trainings. Like, we direct you towards, like, the ICS 100, 200, 700s, all those courses. Our first aid, we recommend, we accept a minimum of a WFA, and a lot of our members have WFERS and OEC because we have some people in ANSP as well. And we try to do like one helicopter training a year to get like dogs at least familiar with the helicopters. And we will sometimes overlap. Dave will help us a lot, and we'll do a training of like do a catch-all of radio and navigation and kind of the survival stuff. I know we'll tag on to some of your courses as far as the I'm blanking on the name, the winter survival course. Yeah. That one will, a lot of our members will join in on that one, and that'll cover a lot of our survival requirements.
All right. So as far as AMRG goes, I guess the biggest thing is kind of what I tell the basic training candidates or our prospectives is the best requirement, the best skill set you can have is being uncomfortable. If that doesn't kind of suit you, then maybe we may not be the best fit. But we really desire a full or competent backcountry skill set. Basic skills, just being very comfortable, experienced in different environments and in different types of weather. Other than that, the formal process is every year we do a basic training class. That lasts, let's just say, about 3 months, and then you move into a prospective status. And once you go through a prospective status, you're able to go into the field, participate in missions, participate in trainings, really get a kind of feel for what we do to see if you're a fit and for us and we're a fit for you. And then after that, it's a simple operational step. As far as certifications, we are a BLS unit. We have a growing number of ALS prospectives and operational folks, so that's exciting. But as far as a unit itself, we are a BLS unit. We require a wilderness first aid. However, I would think at least 70% of the team has a woofer or higher. So that's good. And other than that, an Abbey one with rescue. You won't go into the field. I have a training without a period. And what am I forgetting? Amy, you just went through this. What am I forgetting? Of course, the ICS courses and stuff like that we, the other teams require, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head specifically past that.
Jonathan?
Yes.
Avalanche.
Yeah, Abbey one with rescue, 100%. That's it. Amy, you're up.
Okay, so for Anchorage Nordic, I'm going to say it a different way. So I got recruited into Anchorage Nordic on the ski train. So that's part of our MO too. But to come into Anchorage Nordic, you can find one of us, contact us off the web, this and that, and we run you through our recruiter and our candidate coordinator, Abby, and you get to talk to that smiling face and to learn about what we do and how we do it. And so we kind of see, okay, if you're still a great match, then okay, we're going to get you into our candidate program. And so for candidates in National Ski Patrol applying into Anchorage Nordic, you will learn all of our local protocols, both for races and anything in the backcountry. And then you will also take the Outdoor Emergency Care course, which is our medical credential. It's an EMR plus level in the EMS system. And the other great thing is if you have never had any medical in your life, you can come in and do that. If you're a doc, you can come in and or WEMT, EMT, you can test into it and move a little quicker through. So once you kind of learn our protocols, which includes radio operation, that's probably the other thing we all have in common, then you get your outdoor emergency care, you know our protocols, you've gone through the different types of things that we do, we will put you into a category called patroller, which means you can be on your own. And that's kind of the first step. And then, to be a full Nordic patroller in Anchorage Nordic, you also have to have Avalanche 1 with the National Ski Patrol, which includes a rescue module, plus Mountain Travel and Rescue 1, which is the outdoor kind of survival course. That's how you become a full Nordic patroller. And then in ski patrol, there's trajectory for your career after that, which includes going into an instructor track and or moving to a senior patroller level, which gets into more leadership, taking on a leadership position in either the patrol, the region, or the division. And then for us, there is the Nordic Master, which is kind of the highest level of ski patrolling for us. I'll pass it to Mitch.
Thanks, Amy. So Alaskan's management team likes to steal all the people that have already been there and done that. So the big thing that we look for is individuals with experience to come in that might want to move from field operations to more base operations. Sometimes it's called the headshed, if you want to think about it, of who's going to do all the paperwork and keep track of everybody out in the field. There is ways to get in with limited experience, but initially we look for field SAR experience as part of an existing SAR team. They are the team leaders, the operational leads for those teams that have taken the control, stepped up, know how to do some of the paperwork, want to expand on not just the 98% of the 24-hour missions that are completed and everybody goes home at the end of the day, but what happens when they don't? What happens when we don't find the person in that first operational period? That's where a lot of people get stuck, and that's where we really want to just kind of succeed and step into to help fill those gaps. So again, field experience, SAR personnel, individuals that are experienced in incident command system. There's a lot of other professions out there, from oil response to some of the other agencies that have great backgrounds, from Coasties to individuals in the military, or even just extensive outdoor leadership and guiding services that have been moving through different areas that we've been able to pick up individuals from. The other caveat is those that have very specific technical capabilities. If you ever played with an ArcGIS system, it can be very overwhelming very quickly to figure out mapping. Hence where we pushed out CalTopo, and it's an amazing option if you're a part of SAR team. I hope you play with it almost daily. But it is GIS operations are how we map and show our search efforts was a really big technical thing that we wanted to capitalize on. We were able to streamline that a little bit now with some of the, I'll say, more user-friendly options. There's specific communication areas, there's specific drone operations and specialties that we're looking for that we're able to kind of build out, that we don't have pilots in every back corner pocket of each agency. So for our 107s, actual commercial pilots or so forth, they're able to do a little bit more aviation work for us, how to work through some of those mapping skills and integration of aviation data into maps, again, specialty things. So if you are in the field, and you've been around for a little bit and you want to expand that capability, we'd love to teach and expand that knowledge base for them as well. But again, they don't have to have all of them. They can just have one or two of these areas. Again, we have individuals that come out from amazing military service and careers that want to keep giving back. We work with other nonprofits and NGOs that have that type of kind of field work also. Once they come in as that kind of initial recruitment, we have an application period we review on a quarterly basis. You go to the Alaska Search and Rescue Association's website. We have a small tab off to the side there. Talks about all the team and how we operate. We fluctuate anywhere between 20 and 40 people on the team, depending on how busy we are in the seasons and when people retire out and move to Lower 48 and go traveling and move on to better areas. Right now, I think we're a little bit leaner, around 25 people on the team. So that's pretty thin for a full incident management team, if you think about it. Most IMTs are around 70 plus people, if you look at some of the national team and national frameworks. But we go again between 20 and 40. Our initial training requirements is normally ICS 300, so intermediate to complex incidents. ICS 300 is basic, it's a 3-day in-person class. TEKS offers it online. EMI, or now it's NDMU, National Disaster Emergency Management University. It's the Emergency Management Institute that's been rebranded over in Emmitsburg, Maryland. We offer support for individuals that go through or want to travel out there. We can get them normally free transportation and lodging to get out to those courses. So that's a great in-person opportunity. Also, TEKS provides training that we can send our individuals to down in Texas. the A&M campus out of the Disaster City. And so they have incident management, the MG314 classes that put you through a 7-day or 5 to 7-day complex incident. And as it expands out and calling in USAR teams, and it's an amazing opportunity to go down and get your hands dirty in some of the paperwork portions of incident command. But again, so ICS 300 is the kind of the initial requirement for operational status. We expand up to ICS 400. We then look at having some type of IRIC, initial response incident commander training, SIPC, which is a search incident planning section chief, or the MLPI, missing lost person through NASSAR. There's other trainings out there as well through inland search and rescue through the Air Force. There's other courses that are definitely capable and provide comprehensive education in search management. The other thing is we want to have at least 3 trainings as they become a prospective member and kind of going into the operational. They're on an incident for three different incidents in different positions, working through those positions over the operational periods, getting that experience working as a team, and then kind of getting let loose from there. We work with task books. We are trying to work through either the state or national framework task books. We try to do shadowing with the Forest Service when they go out on wildland fire deployments. That is a great way to see how 1,200 people at a spike camp have to be fed, or how you do a planning period and get everybody briefed and on the same page to buy into the plan, and then brief out that plan, and then redo it 12 hours later. So it's a pretty fast-paced operations that people are able to go through and shadow, which is a great opportunity to learn a little bit more of that in-depth workings of how many people does an outhouse really provide for. So, again, that's just all part of the what we can look for and how the search and rescue management team can support, again, those complex, expanding incidents that hopefully we can be wrapped up within that 24 hours, but not going to the 48-72-96.
Okay, thank you, everyone. That was a nice overview as part of our team introduction to capabilities category.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Next up is a discussion on coordination of search and rescue and responses to natural disasters such as Typhoon Halong in western Alaska.
What does an interagency SAR response look like in practice? Can someone share a recent mission where multiple teams have played complementary roles? And think about sort of like 2 to 3 minutes.
Sorry, Rich. Why is it every mission
I'm on? I think Bird Ridge is like the most recent example of, I think we had just about every single central region search and rescue team involved to some level. We had teams from the Mat-Su come in, we had the Guard come in, we had troopers come in, we had everybody up here on the panel come in. A lot of people in this room were there. So that, I think, was on top of everybody's mind on Bird Ridge. If you guys want to go into a little more detail.
So, Sid, I guess we'll give a little bit of backstory. A gentleman was going out for an afternoon hike, originally going to Plan A was Bird Point, Plan B was that overlook, which is just back from the ridge. He didn't return to his car, experienced hiker. AMRG was called out after APD did a drone search and some other things. We initially started a hasty search, requested dog team for trailing. We were able to cover the hasty section of the search pretty quickly and to identify he wasn't on trail. We actually had a former member complete a much thorough hasty search before we were actually on scene. He was a family friend. After that, I think we very quickly realized that this had a potential to be a much bigger issue. And so we reached out and requested Nordic, the dogs, and everybody else that came out. And it was, quite frankly, from being there from, I think, the second person on the parking lot to one of the last, it was very much appreciated everybody was involved. We had help from all the teams that Amanda had mentioned, additional to the GCI engineers at 3:30 in the morning telling us the cell phone pings at Hope that looked like a track and a trail were not real, so that was helpful. The incident management team being able to kind of take over when we were sleeping in the parking lot underneath cars. The troopers stepped up in a huge way. We were on a helicopter at 8 a.m. to do a visual search, and then the air guard. So, I mean, the system worked. And since I've been on the teams, I guess the one thing I want to highlight is the system truly worked. Another thing that I think worked better than anything was comms. Comms has been the biggest challenge we've had as teams. I mean, it is just the biggest challenge we've had. And that operation, we had all the South Central teams, volunteer teams there. We had the troopers. We had the park, Chickasha Park. We had the Army Guard all being able to use the one channel, State One, or on everybody's older radios, LE Simplex. And it worked. It was, in addition to that, we were also using the air-to-air channel, and hearing the Hilo 3 talk to the Army Guard when they were that close to each other was comforting. So that's all I can add, but it worked. And it was the first time that I saw it truly work. So it was humbling, but also very cool.
How many people in this room were on Bird Ridge? Showing, yep. It was, I think it was helped by the fact that in the past couple years we've been at least having, Anchorage Nordic and ASARD training together, ASARD and AMRG training together, AMRG and Anchorage Nordic training together. Then we've been, AIMT has been involved in some of the recent searches. So it's improving as we get to know each other. It's always really important to kind of know each other's team's strengths, and I think this is another question, I won't jump into it too much, but my first experience, as I told you, I came up here with a lot of oil spill response experience back in 2008, joined the ski patrol after thinking it was cool on the ski train, and then my first big interagency search, I was the second to last person deployed. And the reason why I was the second to last person to deploy is because nobody knew me. And so this is one of the key things that I always tell all of our incoming folks, is that we are so glad to have you, and we want you to come and be very engaged and active with us, because the work we do can be dangerous, and we need to have trust in who are by our sides. So I love seeing everybody in this room. Hope I get to meet some of you that I don't know, either tonight or another day. So, Manch, did you want to add anything
in? I think the biggest thing with interagency response is we all have limitations, and we all need to accept those limitations. We are not robots. We cannot continue going 12, 14, 16, 18 hours on a search. And we need to know, and especially with our leadership, they need to start pulling people back and saying, hey, you need to take a break. There has to be a work-rest ratio integrated into search and rescue. Because I mean, I remember a long time ago working 22, 24 hours, 28 hours on a search, coming back and just crashing. And I'm not effective. And if we would have found somebody, I would have been even less effective. So knowing that we have limitations, we have personnel, we have other, again, there's just limits to what we can and can't do, that we need to call other people in. We need to share the burden within the teams, where we might have a team that gets deployed up quick. They do a great hasty search. They have the information going. We call in secondary teams. Hey, let's bring in dogs. Hey, let's bring in more ground pounders. Hey, at what point do we start calling in all these other nonprofits or NGOs to say, where can we bring in a soup kit? Where can we get a chuck wagon? Where can we get all these other things to keep these people in the parking lots? When do we bring in the tents, the porta potties because the bathrooms are locked, or whatever else? Yeah, we need to make sure that we're not just peeing behind a car. I mean, I don't want you to leave because I want you to get some rest. Yes, if you can sleep in your car, great. If not, lean your seat back and get some shut-eye, because I might need you again in 6 hours. And that's, I think, the big thing that we want to make sure is that with interagency, it's not just because it goes on further, it's because we have limitations. And that's totally acceptable.
One question we got was how our volunteer SAR teams integrated into statewide emergency response. So floods, earthquakes, wildfires, typhoon, how long should we be more involved? What would we need to do to be more involved? Sorry, Amy, this really feels like it's directed at you.
I think Manch and I will share some thoughts, and we will choose our words a little bit. So those of you who know me a long time know that this summer I retired from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. where because I had done all this search and rescue stuff, and you know, oil spill work, I was always working with everybody in NOAA about how can we support the state and municipality in when there's a disaster. Because it's amazing. NOAA has a whole slew of response teams that you never had any idea that we have. And so just that being said, in all the meetings, statewide meetings that I'd sit in, I would typically try to bring up, like, hey, there's other resources out here. And by the way, first, start with NOAA, because we're trained in this and that and the other, and we're paid for. But there's also these other organizations. Every year at the statewide emergency management conference in the spring, so we have this organization that we should probably talk about, Alaska Emergency Management Association, AKEMA, and maybe I'll set you up to talk a little bit about that. And so there's an AKEMA meeting at that conference, and I'm wearing my NOAA vest, at least I was, with my NOAA name tag, and I would always end up talking about what search and rescue was doing. And oh, by the way, boy, did I get everybody looking at me when I said the search and rescue has gotten a statewide license for SAR Topo. Ooh. They're like, how do we get in on that? So I think there's a lot more that we can do. In Ski Patrol, every division, and so we are Alaska Division, we have a medical director, medical lead, and that is Dr. Jen Dow for us. And one of the conversations I've had with Jen is, you know, we're not really connected in to Alaska Respond. Is there a reason we can't be? And if I recall this right, she's like, nope, there isn't. We should work on that. But that's a couple of thoughts from me. Let me pass it over to Manch.
Oh, boy. Where do we go? So my day job, I'm the deputy fire chief for the Gerber Fire Department. I've been down there since 2005. I was also the emergency manager for the University of Alaska Anchorage and all South Central's, for all the South Central campuses for a while. So AKEMA is a brainchild from Casey Cook up in the Mattsu Valley and a couple other EMs, emergency managers, that basically took a national framework and said, we need to do better in Alaska and we need to have some type of accreditation. We have a whole bunch of people that do this work, and how do we recognize it? So that's kind of some of the background I'll talk about quickly here. The other thing is, in the fire world, is USAR. When we say urban search and rescue, the dog guys and the amber alerts and the silver alerts and all those people think of something completely different. In the fire world, it's earthquakes, disasters, natural disasters. It's Alaska for me. That's what I was thinking out, and the fact that we do not have a statewide USAR team, I'm still perplexed by. When we have our closest ones out of Washington State with Task Force One, we have 28 different USAR task force teams in the lower 48 throughout all the different states, but there's zero in Alaska. Yes, the idea is that they can deploy up here very quickly, but again, that initial response is limited. And that's, I think, where search and rescue comes in for a natural disaster response for that initial surge, because that's when we're going to save the most lives. We know that. That's the first 12 hours. Is that how do we go through clear neighborhoods? How do we go through and pull people out of floodwaters? Think about Typhoon Along and the response we had from the National Guard. They did a phenomenal job in the, from the federal side getting out there and bringing people back. We had air transporters that had people packed in at 230 some individuals came in on that first flight that Thursday night, and it was. It was packed shoulder to shoulder, but that's the only way they were able to get them out. So getting more people out there in more devastating areas in a more populated location, I think would be a much bigger issue, and we need to make sure we can take care of Alaska.
That was a discussion on response to statewide disasters such as Typhoon Halong with a group of search and rescue organizations. The discussion was organized by the Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol and was held at the BP Energy Session. We'll continue after this short break with more of Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. We are listening to a discussion of search and rescue in Alaska, and we pick up on the question of volunteers and professional responders working together in SAR operations. Then we move on to their stories of memorable SAR incidences and finish up with how to improve search and rescue effectiveness.
The state SCOC, the State Emergency Operations Center, is based right here in Jay Bear at the Armory. They have, I think, a lot of oversight as they cover pretty much everything outside of Anchorage. that's their primary jurisdiction, and they do a great job. Mark Roberts is a phenomenal director down there that's been doing this for a long. Brian Fisher, all those guys, they really care about Alaska. And when we look at them locally here in Anchorage, the Anchorage Emergency Operations Center under the municipality, they have tasks to help coordinate all large responses. So between fire and police, there's a lot of different things that could go on there. And there is limitations within the fire and the police departments, as we know, where we can be overwhelmed very easily. So yes, search and rescue, in short, needs to be involved. I think there's ways to get into it. I think the emergency management is aware of the idea of search and rescue teams, but I don't think they have the go buttons, besides calling the troopers, as anybody else would.
Yeah, I think it's a valid question. I think it extends itself more than just in Alaska. I know as my role in the Mountain Rescue Association nationally and in Canada, we're struggling with very much the same thing. How do the highly qualified MRA teams respond? They have a unique set of skills, for instance. And how can we complement the more structured or professional, if you will, organizations, the fire departments, the EOCs from the various states and stuff like that. So at the MRA, we're currently looking at how to integrate that, and part of it's terminology, what class, what FEMA response class you are, et cetera, and we have to push through that. But as the person who entered during the Highland Avalanche, entered a person's house from the third floor balcony directly from the avalanche pile, more training to know when it's right to pull the trigger, because definitely we were working out of our comfort zone when we responded to that one, but it's the right thing to do, and we were the best people to be on the pile at that time. So yeah, more interactions, more training, that's a framework. It's a great question that we all need to push.
Okay. Does anyone in the audience have a question on this topic of interagency SAR response that we've talked about? We'll take one from Tom Plowman.
Regarding getting more involved with the official disaster response as opposed to the volunteer SAR community that we fall in, how about getting us perhaps a good way might be to get us involved in some of the exercises that have been held. I know there have been some pretty large, military, Coast Guard, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think any or few, if any, of the volunteer teams have been involved in what Amy talked about earlier. You're not going to get called if they don't know you. So one way to get known would be to get our teams involved in some of those exercises. We could demonstrate our capabilities and then maybe get on. So that's all I
want. Yeah, I'll respond to that one. I want to give a quick shout out to the Juno groups. Jackie with Juno Mountain Rescue, Tom Matisse from the city of Juno. They have worked with the National Guard, they've worked with the local fire departments, EMS services, and the search and rescue team down there, the only other, I think, MRA team in the state for down in Juno, to integrate those into those trainings. And we've been able to come down for some of the larger disaster size scenarios where search and rescue was incorporated into it. And we had the opportunity to help run the actual incident action planning process for those large scale disaster trainings. So again, I think Juno has a further step forward than we do here in Anchorage. They also have an MOU with a memorandum of understanding with the Juno, the Capital City Fire, and Juno Mountain Rescue, where the Mountain Rescue team can be called by the fire department to effect technical rescue. So I think that's something that we haven't seen in almost any other location, where the MRA has really been pushing forward, trying to get that interagency work done. And that is a direct, again, 911 response from a fire department saying, hey, this is outside of our current capabilities with our current staffing. Let's call in the other guys that can assist us and then join in forces and work together to have that mutual aid response.
I recognize that this is an opportunity for people to tell very exciting stories, and so unfortunately you have to keep the story very short, but think back to a mission that did not go as planned. What are some of the key lessons your team took away, and how has it changed your operations or training moving forward? And that would be great to hear from everyone, but also I recognize this could be kind of long answers.
This could be fun from the audience too, actually.
Long story short, not calling soon enough. When we got in over our heads, when did we need to call for assistance, and why did we take so long? So again, multiple times bad weather, all the things going against us, multiple patients, and then when the 210th or 212th guys came and get out there because the weather's so bad, who else are you going to call?
And just from that answer, I think I know the mission. This is just going to be kind of total other end of the spectrum. It's going to be a recent mission that we've focused a lot of time and effort on since March this year, the 20-mile avalanche. Every time we go out, something changed. Every time we found a new clue, something changed. Every time we had a plan, it changed. What I learned from that, and I cannot be prouder of our team and how we were able to just be flexible with it. When you run out of rope on a 400-foot rappel, you have an issue. When you do it more than once, you have a problem. But the way we've been able to come together as a team, especially in the last couple of years with the reduced mission load, has been phenomenal. What it has done with our relationship, AMRG's relationship with the troopers, has been game-changing. The trust we have in each other, the support that we've given each other. I do have to bribe people with snacks and treats, but it truly has allowed us to open the conversation on that state one, that communications platform that's been game-changing for the SAR community, and it's done the opposite, right? It's made everything better. So it was a tragedy. We need to acknowledge that fact, but what we've been able to learn from it has been truly amazing.
When I was thinking about this question, I didn't immediately have a mission that came to mind, but I think Manch and Jonathan kind of hit it on the head of, like, every mission we go on, something goes wrong. It could be something small. Almost always it's a guarantee something with communications is going to go wrong. So really to be flexible, like be able to think on your feet, not to like panic when things go wrong, and be able to think through how to approach getting that job done. Because we all are there with the same goal. So being able to work together, being able to use all these interagency trainings makes working through those speed bumps a lot easier. And so it's like the be flexible and like calling early are like the two big things that I think have like always constantly come up. And it's like you could like what we've been pushing for a lot too is like, hey, you might not need dogs, but call us anyway, let us know something's happening, and like we could start getting our teams like ready and like telling them, hey, get your stuff ready by the door, and so when this call will likely come in, you can get there faster. And so yeah, flexibility is a big, be able to think on your feet.
Yeah, I think it is. What it's call early, call everyone. I mean, how many people have been on a mission where when we get called, it's now day two or day three, the weather has been fabulous, but in the next 12 hours, it's going to go to all heck, blowing 35 plus, no helicopter transportation possible, this and that and the other. I have many missions in my mind. Anybody else experience that one? So I think we're doing better with that in some cases. Thank you to the LT back there. We're getting called earlier, and with, you know, really appreciate your support and being like, who do you need? Call them. Because that's something we have some assistance with now is that we can be very comfortable, no matter which group has been called out, that if we need the other help, we let the lieutenant know and we can get those resources. So that's a big positive change. I think my take on this question, again, kind of is emerging of multiple missions, and it's the one thing that drives me crazy is when I'm sitting walking through a parking lot or walking through somewhere and I hear one team demean another. It's got no place when we're trying to work together to bring somebody home. So, I mean, I think luckily that doesn't happen all the time, but these little things of if you think you're better than the other team, just leave that at home. Leave it at home. So, good news is a lot of these folks in here I see, you guys are really good about bringing everybody up, and I said it to him when I said him, when I walked in and saw Luke Mel, thank you for being here. His newsletter today talks about somebody many of us already know, Mary Giannotti. And Mary, are you there?
Mary's here.
Mary! Hi! And she knows this because I sent her an email about it too. Luke shared about how do you support your co-instructor? How do you lift them up? How do you do this? And I sent that around to the Alaska Division leadership today because I think it's absolutely incredible. And I thank everybody in here who does that on a daily basis. It makes us all better.
Okay, we're going to shift gears again. Shout out to Eric Cannon for this question. We're skipping one of his questions, but aside from sort of technological innovations, what do you think has the greatest potential to improve SAR effectiveness over the next 10 plus years? And how should we train for that? And if you really don't have anything that's non-technology, you can throw technology.
I gotta jump on this one. I'm a little bit of a tech geek. I'll throw that one out there. Satellite communication. If you guys have seen any of the transitions in the last 15 years, we think about from inReaches to now our cell phones. The only thing that we're hindering is the power capability of keeping them charged. By taking power banks or whatever else, I mean, that would be the non-technical-esque technical part of what we need to keep everything else working. People take a little power bank in their backpack. That should be the 11th essential now. Besides a headlamp and everything else, because actually most headlamps are rechargeable now, if you go figure, but it is that power bank. So on that note, though, what's changing and making this is the technology in cell phones. With Starlink being added now to a lot of the new iPhones coming out there, the text-to-satellite functions are amazing. Big shout-out to Caltopo on the let me reach out to you via text message to send me your location and show it on the full map of all search and rescue teams that are actually in this for a mutual aid incident, and they can see where that person is, so it does not go from a search, it goes directly to a rescue, which is awesome, because now we just get them from basically a place of harm out to a place of safety, and it's a huge transition. So technology for me is cell phone communication with satellite uplink, and where that's going to be coming, because we've seen that transition over the last 10, 15 years, and that's been a game changer for us.
Well, on the non-tech side, too, it's still related. It's communication. I mean, just from what I've seen with my limited experience here in, like, just the last 5 years, it's changed just by communication. Everybody's talking more, and that has made searching a lot easier. Everybody kind of knows everybody's capabilities now. Everybody's more willing to work with each other, and that has been a game changer, honestly, in the last 5 years, and it's, I think, only going to get better with technology changes and the ability to stay communicated easier. It's just going to keep improving.
I definitely have to get on the Caltopo bandwagon. The find me, click this, search and rescue is looking for you. We've used that several times with mixed success based off cell phone coverage, but it's there, and it's a work in progress. I also think we have to, as rescuers, we have to acknowledge the backside of this. The ease it is to call search and rescue. I think several of us at one point would say, several years ago, put in your inReach message, require a helicopter with hoist, right? The RCC actively slows down now when they say someone requests with hoist, because do they really need hoist? Aren't they just really tired and don't want to walk the 12 miles out from Peters Creek? Right. And that was a real world mission. So it's, I think we have to acknowledge it and treat it responsibly. But I will say that some of the satellite communications coming from Apple and stuff like that are amazing. We have to understand the limitations. For instance, with Garmin, as responders, we can talk directly to the subject. With Apple, you can't. You have to play a game of telephone. So it would have to go, a question would have to go from me, do I see, to the trooper, to Apple, to the trooper, do I see, back to me. So it's a work in progress, but I definitely think it's there.
Thanks, and one thing I'll add is, what I think is gonna help with the effectiveness is the movement, and this is actually a national movement, to get people into get teams into databases that are nationally known. Manch and I are very interested in moving the SAR community forward into One Responder, which is a Department of Homeland Security effort that started, 10 years ago or so? It's a slow climb on this one. But that will help us know more about each other. It would, you know, the troopers have a resource book. Resource information will be in this. You'll know. Somebody in another, you know, up in the Fairbanks, if they can find out about who are the people who are skilled in X, Y, or Z. We can do, and basically what I'm saying is that it will increase our ability to do mutual aid, which I think will be really useful. My tech thing, because I'm a planning section chief, and I love that fun problem-solving side, is I really think that AI is going to explode and be a helpful. It's going to be really rough at the beginning as we have to keep checking it, but I think there's going to be tools that will help us get our people to the best places to bring people home in the best condition possible.
Okay, we're going to solicit audience questions again after this question, so think about them. This question was submitted by Luke Mel, and it's, from a prevention standpoint, what public safety messaging is working and what isn't? How can we as a rescue group, rescue community, better promote a culture of safety?
And cell phones cannot call 911. With that, I'll add one more thing on the culture of safety is, I think we've lost the push for having trip plans. There's a great push, I think, in the early 2000s. We saw a lot of that information coming out. There are people creating trip plans, having them either staged at their home in a letter, in a saved on a document, on a drive, given to a family member, texted. The photo at the trailhead that you send to your family saying, this is what we look like, see you in 6 hours. And that type of thing, or call 911 and 12 if you don't hear from me. I haven't seen that as much, personally. I don't know if other people have that same experience, but that's one of the things that I found that has been lacking, and I think it's a very easy PR campaign to get back onto, not the social media hashtag-esque process that some of us try to avoid at all cost. But there is some things where people, it is good to have that outward publicity, at least, of that individual being able to showcase what they're doing and having that in a safe area so it can be captured and hopefully utilized in an actual mission.
Just a quick shout out to the avalanche centers in the room. My mom calls me with the avalanche reports, so that's working. She called me actually today. She did not advise me going to turn again, so thanks, Andrew. Appreciate it. I can't say enough about that. I will do a very, very quick plug because I feel like I need to. One of the things that the hardest thing to do is have a first responder talk to a subject or some folks in trouble or folks in the backcountry that are aware of a situation, stuff like that. So one of the things that we started earlier this year, trying to figure out the comm size for first responders to first responder, has now morphed into first responder to subject, civilian, if you will. And with the help of a very tenacious PJ and the RCC, they've really kind of embraced the Family Service Band Channel 1 as when something goes wrong, hop on Channel 1 and ask for help. Now, there's some technology limitations there, and it's a really new thought process. I know it's resurfaced a couple years ago with 911 on the Family Band radios. That didn't catch a lot of traction for numerous reasons, but that utilizing that Channel 1 if you need help is a great thing, but it requires several steps, and it's going to require a champion. For what it's worth, the RCC, the PJs, or the Air Guard, if they're responding, that's the gray helicopters, will be scanning those Family Band radios, are supposed to be scanning. I did confirm with a couple pilots in the last month or so that they are, but it's kind of a start, so.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, too, that this avalanche education in general is kind of the perfect example of, like, safety messaging doing its job. I've seen, like, the culture of backcountry skiing and snowboarding change in, like, the last 5-10 years of, like, it is rare to be with someone not wearing a beacon, whereas probably 10, 15, 20 years ago, it was a little on the opposite side of it was rare to see people have all the safety equipment. And so that has been working, all the education, all the forecasting, all the just all that public outreach for that. And I know there was a big push, I think, I don't know how many years ago, to get like all the snow machiners more on board. And I've seen that like improve hugely in the last 5 years. And that has worked. I was kind of mulling over this question on, it feels like we have kind of winter travel figured out where people are a little more on board with the safety messaging, but with a lot more of the realities of being in Alaska and everybody has this level of independence attached to going out and recreating outdoors, it's an interesting problem to think through on like how to get people as on board with as they are with beacons and all the avalanche safety as they would be going into just going on a day hike. And I think there is a level of overconfidence in their technology. Like that's kind of the flip side of technology is people are getting lost less, but when they get lost, they are much less prepared to be lost. And I don't know the answer on how to get people on board.
I like that you brought that up, Amanda. I've got one little thing specifically for the Anchorage area is maybe let's not encourage every visitor to Anchorage to take flat top front side as their first hike.
It's the books, man.
And so, but I use that as kind of a funny segue into talking about, you know, generally our rescues are for Alaskans, but I really worry about folks coming up here and, you know, dependence on devices from places where the devices work. So that's something that I don't think has really reared its head yet, but it's something on my horizon of, I hope we're okay with this.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardot. We have two students here talking about the Alaska Pacific University Clear Swap. Nathan and Gavin, welcome to the show. Go ahead and tell us a bit about the event.
Thank you, Paul. We'll be at the Mosley Sports Center on the APU campus. The main event is Saturday, April 4th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. For anyone looking to sell their own gear, we do have two drop-off windows, Friday, April 3rd from 4:30 to 7 p.m. and early Saturday morning from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m.
And to get involved, if you want to sell your own gear, you just go ahead and get on Google, type in Alaska Pacific University Gear Swap 2026, and it should be the first link to pop up. And you just go through the steps and register to get your gear registered to sell. But there is also a lot of gear to purchase for just about anything outdoors, just like Nathan said.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. And what kind of gear are we talking about again?
We will have just about everything that you need for an adventure in Alaska. We're expecting to have skis, watercraft such as pack rafts, kayaks, and maybe even canoes, tents, and various camping supplies.
All right, I took a lot of clothes too, as I recall.
Yeah, those too, for sure.
Excellent. And what does it cost? Does it cost anything?
there will be a 15% commission for all sales that will be used to support our outdoor program.
All right, and support, I my impression from the past when we've done this is that you're helping students out with equipment and the poor Brook College students, which I assume you guys are.
Yep.
Very good. And what, so if I get myself registered and I'm going to, when do I drop my gear off then? Yeah, when?
So you could drop your gear off on Friday, April 3rd from 4:30 to 7 p.m. or early on Saturday morning from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m.
All right. And then if I want to buy something, which is an awesome thing for probably a pretty good deal, when does that start again?
That starts on Saturday, April 4th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m.
All right. Excellent. Now, let's say my gear is not sold. What happens then?
All gear that is not picked up by 2 p.m. on Saturday after the event will be donated to the Outdoor Studies program.
All right. Excellent. Very good. Well, thank you very much, guys. And again, how do I find out about the gear swap?
So finding out about the gear swap, you'll go ahead and get on Google, type in Alaska Pacific University Gear Swap 2026, and it should be the first link to pop up with all the information there.
All right, that's excellent. And again, that is this Saturday, April 4th. So we hope to see everybody there. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
For more information on Alaska search and rescue organizations, go to this show's webpage by searching for Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. We even spell out some of the acronyms used by the panelists. For information on the APU Clear Swap, search for Alaska Pacific University Clear Swap 2026. Thanks to all my guests. I'm your host, Paul Torlak, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, let's get ready for spring and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.